Hello, everybody. Welcome to Open Door Philosophy. I'm Andrew Graziano, and over there is the very stoic Taylor Jones.
Hello, everyone.
And over here is the man without an intellectual country, Mr. Parsons.
Hello, everyone. I have eschewed my citizenship.
And welcome to episode 59, where we explore the life and philosophy of one of the most influential philosophers of the 20th century by asking, who was Bertrand Russell? But first, how's it going, guys?
Hey, Andrew. Doing great. And by the way, Andrew's back. Welcome back, Andrew, from your many adventures. Of course, you'll talk about that on your catch-up, but we're glad that you're back. Well, my life is great because summer has begun. I'm done. We had graduation. Students are gone. I'm still doing some work, to be honest, but it's not work with students. So all that's very exciting. And here in a week or two, I will be in Colorado and it will be fantastic. And I can't wait. So that's what's going on. How about you, Taylor?
I'm doing good. I've been on summer, I think, 3 weeks now. So I'm starting to kind of be really settled in. Everything's unpacked. I've seen my Nana a couple of times, seen lots of family, started crocheting again. Lots of very, very exciting things happening here. How are you, Andrew?
No, that sounds great. My mom's a big crocheter, so I'm a crochet fan for life.
You're crochet stan?
Crochet stan, yeah.
Heard it here first.
Yeah, I need to start like a fan club or something.
Mm-hmm.
I just got back. Actually, since the last time I think we recorded, I have graduated college officially, and I was gone for about 3 weeks. So I just got back this past Sunday, which is about a week from today of this time of this recording. So I'm kind of tired still, but I had a lot of fun, saw a lot of really cool stuff. And yeah, that's it.
Well, where'd you go? You got to tell us where you went.
So I started in, you'll know I'm laughing in a second, but I started in Madrid. Which is one of my favorite cities. I think it's not as popular of a tourist destination as Barcelona, which I went next on the trip to. But Madrid was really cool. My favorite thing, one of my favorite things that I did on the trip was in Madrid, which was bullfighting.
Oh.
I saw some classic.
Wow.
Yeah. So I saw some bullfighting. It's really artsy. It's gruesome. The bull dies at the end. But it's a great...
Do you not know that, Taylor?
No.
Yeah.
I think a lot of my friends didn't know it was happening. So when he stuck the sword in the side of the bull, yeah, it's gruesome, but it's beautiful. It's like an art. The stadium that we were in held about 25,000 people. And, you know, I guess they grew up with it, so they appreciate it a lot more than I do. But it's just a beautiful array of life. You're just seeing this animal and this matador fight it out. And there's this really cool part where the bull will kind of take a few steps back and look at the matador, and the entire crowd, I guess they just know the sport so well, will all go silent. They will all stop talking, all 25,000. And you can hear it's a big stadium. I was at the very top of it, and you can hear the matador talking to the bull.
Mm.
And it's really, really special. So I recommend if anyone's in Spain, check that out. It's really, really fascinating. Yeah. Really stoic too.
I think of that old Bugs Bunny cartoon where he's the matador.
I haven't seen it.
He's fighting the bull. Yeah, that may be, I don't know. I just showed my age there or whatever. It's really funny. What was a highlight from Italy?
I think highlight from Italy was definitely Rome. St. Peter's is a amazing place to be, especially as a Catholic. But Rome is just so historical, even if you're not Catholic. But Rome is an amazing place.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, you beat Taylor and I this week for distance traveled and cool points.
Yeah.
It was great, but very tiring. So I'm envious of y'all.
In our leisure.
Yeah.
Well, all right.
We're excited to talk about Russell today. He was a fascinating man with a lot to say about the world.
He had a whole lot to say. He was a true polymath with interest in It's just all kinds of things. It's really just kind of mind-blowing how much he wrote about mathematics, logic, philosophy, of course, politics, and social reform.
Yeah, and with someone with all of that gusto behind their writing and their public persona, he's bound to be a controversial figure, which he was. And he was often a very outspoken in his criticism of the status quo, especially in social reform.
But he was also a profound thinker. And his ideas have had a profound impact on the way we think about the world.
Yeah, yeah. So, Andrew, get us started.
Bertrand Russell. Bertrand. Okay, sorry. Sound like an NPR host or something. So we'll start off with a little bit of a background on Bertrand Russell's life. He was born in 1872 to a very wealthy and aristocratic family in England. And I think something that just keeps surprising me when I keep learning about him in my research for this episode is he lived a really long time. He died in 1970. So he lived almost till he was 100 years old.
Yeah.
There's a very famous interview. He did an interview, I think, with the BBC. It's about 25 minutes long. And he talks a little bit about in it how his grandfather fought alongside Napoleon. And so the lineage or the length of life on this guy, but also his family, like I said, an aristocratic family, goes way back in English history. I believe Queen Victoria asked his dad, I'm pretty sure it was his dad, to form three separate governments. So he's big into British society and British life. And I think unsurprisingly, with such an aristocratic family, he's going to have some of the best education that a child could have during this time. He was educated at some of the best schools in the country, but he was also a really, really brilliant child. In some of the research that I've done, I don't know if this is true or not. I didn't know him, but it says that at the age of 12, he was questioning whether he had free will or not, which is kind of a brutal thing to think about. And he later said in his life that he was really depressed when he was in his teenage years, and he was very suicidal too. Mm. And what eventually saved his life was his love for mathematics, which is probably the nerdiest thing I've ever heard in my life. But,
Well, you know, I kind of wonder when you say all that, I kind of wonder how Bertrand Russell would have been as a child, like now, like in 2020, well, 2023, you know, with all these thoughts and brilliant aspect. I just wonder like how he would be identified at school and what his trajectory might be. And if it might be different, just interesting to think about with these highly intellectual people. You know, like think of all the diagnoses we have today and everything, like, you know, would he be diagnosed with ADHD or like somewhere on the spectrum with autism or something like that? Be kind of interesting to know. Our next episode, which is Ludwig Wittgenstein, most definitely would have had a diagnosis of some kind.
Yeah.
Very intense individual. And he was probably autistic to some degree.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. It just popped in my head. Thought that'd be interesting.
No, that's really interesting. And you know, we'll keep going in a second, but now that you brought this up, the fact that he lived until the 1970s is really interesting, because I think it's really easy for us to look at these. I mean, Bertrand Russell is one of those great philosophers of history, at least from an educational standpoint. And the fact that he lived in times where my parents were alive, that's I think, pretty interesting. I mean, my parents were babies at the time, but but it's still, I think, really monumental for us to look back on now.
Yeah. Well, I totally derailed this biography. I'll add one quick biographical fact.
Sure.
He smoked a pipe.
Yep.
Love a good philosopher with a pipe.
I don't know what it is about those British, famous British authors with their pipes. I mean, we have Tolkien. We have Tolkien. Yeah. We have Russell. We have... C.S. Lewis, right? Yeah.
I think Iyer had a pipe.
Yeah, yeah. I think he did. Yeah. Probably Mackie had a pipe. I don't know.
Is that a British thing? Do the British smoke a lot?
Not as much as the French.
Or is it just a philosopher thing?
Yeah. Sartre smoked a pipe.
That is the thing with the French.
Maybe it's a philosopher thing.
Yeah.
Maybe
There's
it's a philosopher thing.
Of him, like at cafes.
It goes good with coffee, I guess. I don't know.
Sounds disgusting. You're sorry. I'm not going to talk about that. Anyways,
All right, get us back on track here, Andrew.
Well, so he went to Cambridge University. He studied mathematics and philosophy, graduated near the top of his class at Cambridge, and eventually became a... So he did his PhD, or whatever the British equivalent of, in mathematics. I forget what his thesis was on. I believe it was in set theory. And eventually he basically became a lecturer. I forget what the British word for that was, but he became a lecturer. At this time, too, we see that he's developing friendships with some of these. We'll talk about it in a second. He started creating some friendships with what we will eventually know as the founders of the analytic philosophical movement, which Russell was a part of himself. But I'm mainly thinking of G.E. Moore, who I think was one of his kind of mentors, and Alfred North Whitehead, who he wrote Principia with. And both of those men were basically founders of what is now known as mathematical logic, which we're going to talk a lot about. So it's this intersection between, obviously, math and logic, which was a big deal. There's a lot of argumentation around what logic's relationship was with math. And his Principia, there's some arguments about that. G.E. Moore, one of Russell's friends and mentors, has this really famous essay written in 1925. It's called A Proof of an External World. And this is one of the most famous papers in epistemology. The argument is laid out as he holds up one hand. So he's giving a lecture. It's an argument against philosophical skepticism. So he says, here's one hand. Here's another hand. There's at least two external objects outside of my mind that exist in this world. And from that, he deduces that an external world exists. Russell's...
Take that, Descartes.
Yep. Yeah.
That's great.
Fun paper. I recommend it. It's like 3 pages long. Very short, very readable. Highly recommend.
You know, Whitehead, and I may be wrong on this, Whitehead, I've run into Whitehead a lot of times when studying American philosophy, and I don't know that he was a pragmatist, but he's like pragmatist adjacent. He was during that time period when James and Dewey, about the same time period. So I don't know if he's a pragmatist, but he's American.
I was thinking of Alfred North Whitehead for something else. I can't remember exactly what, but...
He has a famous quote on Plato that everyone likes to love or hate.
Yeah. I think Bertrand Russell's most famous philosophical work, not necessarily most popular philosophical work, but of the... I think his most important... Even maybe important, groundbreaking.
It put him on the map.
Yeah, it's what put him on the map was a 3-volume work on the foundations of mathematics written, co-authored between Russell and Alfred North Whitehead called the Principia Mathematica. And it is, I believe, published in 1910 to 1913, since there's 3 volumes. And it's one of the most influential works in the history of mathematics. This was... basically the foundation for modern mathematical logic. The goal was to provide a rigorous foundation and a complete one for mathematics based on logic alone. Russell and Wittgenstein later at this point believed that all mathematical truths could be derived from a small number of logical axioms. So a logical axiom is just a thing that we hold to be true. It's kind of like a first principle. And so this was a big problem in mathematics at this time, or a big debate. And so what Russell and Whitehead had to do to prove that mathematical truths existed was that they had to develop a new system of logic that was more powerful, which sounds kind of, you know, daunting and Harry Potter-like, than anything that had been before. Now, if we remember... Where was the last 1900 years of logic came from? Straight from who?
Aristotle? Plato?
Yeah, exactly. Aristotle's the big one, but Plato certainly too. So that's, it's super exciting. So Russell and Whitehead are kind of tearing that apart, building on it is maybe a better way. And how they use that was they were just trying to define basic concepts of mathematics, the number, the set, functions. And then they wanted to prove a bunch of math theorems starting from those small number of axioms. So a really famous example of this is, I mean, this is a huge book, right? Like three volumes, hundreds of pages long. A really famous, let me look up how many pages exactly.
I mean, you're really selling me on this. I would love to read a book about mathematics that's hundreds and hundreds of pages long.
Yeah. No, it's great, right?
No, totally appreciate it.
Math based on logic, too. That's your favorite thing.
So he spent 360 pages trying to prove that 1 plus 1 equaled 2. take a second to think about that.
Oh, man. Okay, so here's a good place for me to say this.
Yeah.
This is what's fascinating about Russell. Okay, he's writing this, what I would call a wildly ridiculous book on mathematics, and which of course I will never read, but he also wrote a book called The Conquest of Happiness, and now he's talking about how to live a good life. I mean, when you talk about, he was a polymath, he wrote about so many different things, and it's amazing to me that the thing that put him on the map was this co-authored book on mathematics and logic. And you look at some of the rest of his career and he just writes on so many different topics really well. Just really, really impressive.
Yeah. And it's funny that you said, I think you said it's kind of a ridiculous book or something like that.
I can't back up that claim.
No, but what's really funny is that, you know, a lot of people think that's right. A lot of people think that it was just a load of garbage. I mean, unsurprisingly. And I think one of the biggest people who thought that was Wittgenstein. He thought that the work was complete load of garbage. He has a really nice quote about...
From Wittgenstein?
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I forget exactly what he said. I can't find it now, but I think he basically said it was a load of garbage. And we'll talk a lot about that more because Wittgenstein originally really agreed. I mean, he was one of the guys that Russell was bouncing ideas off of. Other mathematicians, there's this really famous guy named Gödel, who we actually talked about in a past episode. I don't know if you remember it, but we talked about it in one of the proofs of God, the logical proof of God, the ontological proof of God. Gödel is a very famous mathematician who thought that logic... He thought he devised a logical proof that proved God's existence. And what's really funny about that proof, I mean, and that's the reason I'm talking about this, is because it's built upon Russell's foundation of logic. And it's kind of ironic because Russell was a firm atheist, a very, very famous atheist. He stopped believing at God on the around the age of 12 or 13. Gödel's proof has been run by computers that have said that the proof is valid, which is really interesting. So that's all I have to say.
But has ChatGPT verified it?
Let me look it up. Let's see what ChatGPT says.
Yeah, let's just run it through there.
I forget what it's called. Is it called God's proof, the Gödel's ontological proof? Okay, I'm asking. Okay, giving me way too much info. Like usual, it said, okay, it didn't say anything useful. So ChatGPT sucks.
Thanks, ChatGPT. Boo.
Yeah. So anyways, I
go just get a job. ChatGPT, do something with yourself.
It's just, I prefer to use Google Bard now because I like to feed into the system. Yeah, it's much better. Anyway.
What is Google Bard?
It's their AI.
It's an experimental version of, and what's cool about Google Bard is it's connected to Google search engines, where ChatGPT is only up to date from 2021. So,
I mean, there's an arms race going on with developers and AI. Yeah, just wait.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot.
I'm really interested to see what Apple comes up with. So we're off track. Oh, yes. Anyways,
yeah. Apple's going to be crazy. But what's probably cool, I bet a lot of this AI stuff, I mean, modern computer science uses the principles that Russell created in his mathematical logic. I mean, mathematical logic and computer science is very related. Mathematicians call a big field in mathematics now is called set theory.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've heard of that. This.
Mm-hmm.
That is pure mathematical logic, and it's essential to modern computer science.
Yeah.
So,
hey, man, I just want to talk about my feelings.
Well, that's another thing that's another thing Russell's great at. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Which one? Conquest of Happiness? Is that what you want to talk about?
Yeah, let's talk about Conquest.
Well, I don't know if I'll ever read that 3-volume mathematical logic book, but I have read 2 of Russell's books. One is The Conquest of Happiness. The other is Problems of Philosophy. I have other books by him that I just haven't read yet. I have History of Western Philosophy, and I have Why I'm Not a Christian. But anyway, Conquest of Happiness. Yeah, we've already alluded to it. So let's talk about that here for a minute, and we'll see just how wildly different we're talking about here from his mathematical logic. So Conquest of Happiness was published in 1930. So that's Great Depression and leading up into all the chaos that would happen in the 30s in Germany. And so he writes this book about basically how you can achieve happiness, which sounds totally something you would find on the self-help section of the bookstore, right? And you know what? His advice, there's nothing special about it. I've done so much reading on philosophies of life that the commonalities between all of them, which transcends culture and time, the advice is generally the same, which is fascinating to me. But here's what he had. So you can achieve, obviously this is paraphrased. You can achieve true happiness through self-transformation by overcoming self-centeredness. Oh, wow. Ego. Embracing individuality and cultivating a sense of purpose that extends beyond your own personal desires, right? So I want to talk about each one of those, but just very briefly. I don't know, any comments at this point?
It sounds about like everything that we've been talking about, especially the last couple of weeks with our transcendentalist episode, and then talking about even the Tao Te Ching and Confucianism and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me that he's talking about these things in 1930. And yeah. I'll just read some of them and think about it like in our own current context, but then also like 1930, this was still going on. His first point is a big one, is many people are burdened by self-centeredness, excessive worry, and the pursuit of external validation. Well, what does that sound like?
Well, now that I'm thinking about it, it honestly sounds like something that John Green would say on like Log Brothers, or that he would write.
Yeah.
With his hand in his hair.
Well, it totally makes me think of social media. Mm-hmm. I hate to be the old man in the room harping on social media, but pursuit of external validation. Mm-hmm. But that existed before social media, obviously. I mean, even Marcus Aurelius was talking about, you know, don't worry about being famous. Mm-hmm. What is people's applause? It's like dry leaves blowing in the wind.
I love that.
So second here is we got overcoming what he called self-absorption, which kind of sounds similar to the previous one, mm-hmm. but also developing genuine interests and passions that extend beyond one's own immediate concerns. This is like simply taking care of other people. Mm. Encourages individuals to engage in activities that contribute to the well-being of others and to the larger society. Well, how about that? And I do think it's interesting how so many people talk about the epidemic of loneliness that we have in our country, that the British even created a government position just to address the problem of loneliness.
Aww.
And there's lots of things to talk about that. But, you know, here, Russell just gives the same old age old good advice, which is don't be about you, be about others. Engage in activities that contribute to the well-being of others. It's just so simple. Well, it's not so simple, obviously, but the advice is simple, right? So the third one, we have another overcoming. So the third one is to overcome the fear of public opinion and societal expectations. All right. So Andrew, this is going to hurt, but It's got to do a little Dr. Evil pinky thing here and say existentialism. But fear of public opinion and societal expectations. So yeah. He argues that individuals, we often fall victim to conformism and conform to societal norms and values that just may not align with our own authentic selves. And so Russell advocates for embracing one's individuality, pursuing these personal goals and desires, and not being overly concerned with the judgments of others, which might be a little contradictory with the previous one, because we're talking about contributing to the well-being of others in the larger society. But nonetheless, there's a big emphasis on this and the conquest of happiness.
That reminds me of a certain French philosopher that we love to talk about.
Or three.
A few.
Well, you know, Russell is famous in the philosophical world for being wrong. So I don't expect nothing less.
Ouch. Okay. Hey, I guess an entirely expected salvo from Andrew.
All right. I start to lose the interest at the authentic self part. But it's fine. I'm fine with the stuff before it because it's okay. Like, that's all a philosophy, right? Like, society's usually wrong about things, but the authentic self thing is like looking at a fly or something, a fly. You just can't eat the food after you see the fly in it.
What?
Because the fly is thrown up on the food to try to digest it.
Yeah.
Oh man. Well, that's fine.
Well, maybe you're just not being your authentic self, Andrew.
Yeah, you got to embrace your authentic self, man.
I think I am.
You're rejecting.
The irony is, you are being your authentic self.
Yeah.
I think by raging against authenticity.
Yeah. I am the true existentialist.
After all this time. Andrew was an existentialist all along.
He really is.
Sky Cleary's been tutoring me for the past, I know, like year.
Oh, that's fabulous. Okay, well, let me do this last one here. So the last one is self-acceptance and self-esteem. So in The Conquest of Happiness, he talks about that individuals should strive to understand and accept themselves, including their flaws and their imperfections, without excessive self-criticism. And that also reminds me of a lot of thinking today's society about body image and things such as that. Accept yourself, Andrew.
I'm accepted.
So, like, in stark contrast to what Andrew was talking about earlier with the mathematics and logic. So that's just one of the things apparently is wrong a lot, apparently.
I don't know. I don't know much about. I mean, I'm not going to spend the 800 pages reading that book. So I'm not. I don't have an opinion, but I will default to Wittgenstein because he's a freaking probably smartest guy ever in philosophy. I'm not a big fan of. It's not a big deal. I love Russell. The reason I love him so much is because of this book, A History of Western Philosophy.
Okay, let's talk about that.
This is his most famous book, I think.
It's probably most widely read.
If for philosophy.
Yeah.
Either this or Why I'm Not a Christian. This is also probably one of the most famous books on Western, a comprehensive history of Western philosophy, I would say. Maybe there's one other book that I'm thinking of, but let me see. I bet if I put this in Amazon right now, it's going to be the number one book. Let's see.
Yeah, and I'm only guessing it's the most widely read just simply because of its content. I mean, it's an overview of Western philosophy that a lot of people, I think, would be interested in.
I think if anyone was interested in a comprehensive account of philosophy that's very well written and is fair, I think this is the best place to start in all of philosophy. So that's just my endorsement. That's not a ODP endorsement in any regard. But the book is, I'm not exactly sure when it was written. Let me see, actually. I'm going to guess 1950s. 46. 1946. Okay. A little bit off. A History of Western Philosophy. It was written in 1946 or published in 1946. I'm sure it took a long time to write. Very comprehensive account of A History of Western Philosophy.
It's a big book.
It's a big book. It's a really thick book. You can just read it in passages. That's what I've done for a few areas of philosophy, even to prepare for this podcast. It's divided into three sections. And you can, if you're interested in ancient philosophy, you can just stick with the ancient philosophy section. I'm getting more interested into medieval philosophy. So there's an entire section on that. And then there's a final section on modern philosophy. So those are the three parts, ancient, medieval, and modern. The modern one goes up to the logical atomists of the early 20th century. I mean, and it's just like 4 pages long. But it goes up to there, has a little bit on Dewey too, but I think that's about as modern as it goes for him. So there's three parts. Each part's divided into chapters on individual philosophers or philosophical movements. So I'm pretty sure it starts with Plato. Might start with the pre-Socratics, but I think it starts with Plato and works its way up to modern philosophers. And the great thing about Russell too is he's a fantastic writer.
He is.
He's a really great writer. He's easy to read and he's fun to read too. So it's not reading some kind of textbook. I mean, even though it kind of is a textbook.
Yeah, this isn't Hegel or Heidegger or something. His writing is clear and as enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. No, he's a great writer. In fact, I don't know if y'all are aware of this, but Bertrand Russell won a Nobel Prize in 1950, and he won it not in math or economics. He did teach some economics.
For what?
He won it for literature in 1950 for his varied and significant writings in which he champions humanitarian ideals and freedom of thought, end quote. So he's a fantastic writer. Even the Nobels say so.
Well, if the Swedish say it, then it's right.
It has to be true. Has to be true. He wrote it for a few reasons. I think, obviously, the first one is to provide a really needed, comprehensive account of Western philosophy, which is really cool, right? But what do you do when you write a comprehensive account of philosophy?
Well, I think the biggest difficulty would be to pick and choose what you include and don't include. Mm-hmm.
That's a fantastic point, and that's a great piece of criticism too, of it. And I think there's something underlying that too. When you decide what's worth to include in a comprehensive account of Western philosophy, you're showing how what philosophy in the past has led to you today. And so what I think it's showing is this natural progression towards maybe a more logical atomist or a Thomist philosophical viewpoint. And what's really cool in that too is stringing all of these philosophers together, showing how everything depends on each other, which I think is really true. You're never going to hear me criticize that, but I think that's something good. I have two more points on this that I wanted to talk about, but do y'all have anything y'all want to add or anything? Have either of y'all read any selections from this book before?
I have, not many. It's on my shelf at work, actually. It's a very nice copy of it. It's a nice one to have on the shelf. But I look at it all the time. I'm just like, oh, I'd love to read that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, it's 700 pages. What are you going to say, Taylor?
I don't think I have, but I'm taking 2 history of philosophy courses next semester, so
sure.
It may be coming my way.
History of philosophy is my favorite philosophy. You probably know that by now, though, but I'm a big history of philosophy fan. So Russell, in this book, it's not necessarily it's not kind of just presenting his philosopher's works. He also criticizes the philosophers in there, too. In his Aristotle chapter, he does a lot of criticism on Aristotle, which is warranted, right? Like, Aristotle's wrong about a lot of things. But he criticizes philosophers too. But I think it's pretty fair and balanced. He's not kind of stretching. It's balanced criticism. And I think he's also really skilled in putting and stringing all of these philosophers together. He's good about transitioning from, for example, Plato to Aristotle, and from Aristotle to the later medievalist, and showing how their work is apparent in each other. Easy to read. Yeah, it's really good.
That's cool.
He's a great writer. And I think finally, some of the key points that he brings in it are talks a lot about reality. He talks a lot about how we know the world around us, because that's a big problem for philosophers. But just as you said, you know, Mr. Parsons, he has to choose not only the philosophers he includes in the book, but he also has to decide which ideas he's presenting in the book too, right? And the some that he really likes to focus on is reality, epistemology, morality, and really religion too. And that's, I think, where the book gets the most points of criticism. Russell's not a fan of religion. So a lot of people say that he doesn't spend a lot of time or he's not very charitable to the religious arguments. And he also doesn't talk a lot about women in the book either. So,
well, there weren't many women philosophers at that point.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's some medievalists he could have included, but.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Taylor, speaking of the nature of reality, Taylor, you have a very special relationship with Bertrand Russell. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the very first philosophical reading I ever did was Bertrand Russell, assigned by the one and only Mr. Parsons. It was what, my second day of philosophy? And you're like, okay, here you go. And it was chapter one of The Problems of Philosophy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Where he introduces this brown table metaphor, where he goes through and describes, if you're sitting or looking at a circular brown table that has three legs and it's polished in this way, you're going to see it as brown. But if the light hits it in this way or that way, it's going to look different, and it may look black or it may look tan. Or you may see it as more oblong or shorter or taller or any way different than it actually is, as a metaphor for how perspective changes the way you view reality. And I thought that he just beat this metaphor into the ground. And then I learned it continues in chapter
It does.
Two. But it was also really kind of meta for me, because I read it sitting at a round brown table in Mr. Parsons' office. So my head was kind of exploding as my first introduction to philosophy. But definitely something that's stuck with me for the last 2 years.
Yeah. Okay. So I have a question for you. Philosophy can have a reputation of just being self-indulgent and ridiculous. This could be an example of that. After reading, after reading 25 pages of a guy talking about a brown table, why didn't you run the other direction?
That's a great question. I really don't know the answer to that. But
what were you thinking? You're like, what am I getting into here?
Yeah, I definitely was. Well, I mean, part of me being in the class was because I needed it for IB.
Well, that's true.
But I don't know. He got his point across. He served his purpose, and it was incredibly memorable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he did something right.
I remember that you saying, I think when we were first starting this podcast, talking about this, so this must have made an impression on you.
Yes, for sure.
I guess, is it a thing that people who are in philosophy kind of always remember their first piece of philosophy they read? I mean, for me, it was Allegory of the Cave, which is probably no surprise, but what was it? Andrew, I think you've said before it was The Republic.
Yeah, first book of the Republic. Yeah.
I think the second thing you had me read was Allegory of the Cave.
Oh, yeah. It's foundational.
Or maybe not. That was very early.
Well, I probably did, because what Bertrand was talking about was nature of reality. And so that's it's a great segue into Allegory of the Cave. Episode two, by the way, is our most listened to episode still.
Still.
I don't think it's, I don't think it's ever going to be taken down. I can't believe our second episode, because we were so good back then, is our most listened to episode. It's on Allegory of the Cave.
I think on YouTube, it is not our most listened to episode, but it's up there, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
It's interesting that it's still up there. Still. Speaking of, we have a YouTube channel, everyone. So you should go check out our YouTube channel.
Yeah. If you can't listen to it on your phone or whatever else, go listen to it on YouTube. So another thing that Bertrand Russell talked a lot about, and these are some of the things that kind of makes him a bit controversial from time to time. He talked a lot about the need for freedom and democracy and the importance of social justice. So he really criticized the exercise of power and wealth in capitalistic systems. He was not an anti-capitalist, but he felt like that social justice necessitates this constraint on privilege to prevent, you know, oppression for the less fortunate. In fact, here's a quote from him. Advocates of capitalism are very apt to appeal to the sacred principle of liberty, which are embodied in one maxim. The fortunate must not be restrained in the exercise of tyranny over the unfortunate. But he talked a lot about social justice and social justice concerns, so I kind of want to talk about each of those and get y'all's take on them. I have six here that I just kind of pieced together. So the first is peace and disarmament. Now, let's remember the time that he's writing. He lived through World War One and II. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, everyone kind of always thinks it ends there. It doesn't. The first 10 years after the end of World War II is the beginning of the Cold War and then the Korean War.
Even before that, it was German unification. And then there's there's peace across Europe, but there's so many little proxy wars outside of Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great Britain is all involved in.
Yeah. Even leading up to World War One, you have all that conflict mm-hmm. over imperial holdings and. Yeah, so he was a big anti-war activist and advocated for disarmament. He always speaked out against arms races. That was very important leading up to World War One. Very against nuclear weapons, militarism. So he's really kind of cut from the Woodrow Wilson cloth. I don't know if that's a fair comparison, but he believed in the importance of resolving conflicts through peaceful means. And promoted international cooperation to try to achieve a lasting peace. So he was very vocal about peace and disarmament. He was an anti-war guy.
Extremely. The thing about Russell, too, I'm unsure if we've highlighted, is he was kind of a famous guy more close to the end of his life. I mean, you know, very famous. In 1961, when he was 89 years old, he was arrested basically for protesting nuclear arms. In 1962, very famous for sending, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he's famous for sending President Kennedy at that time a telegram, you know, just having the ability to do that. In his telegram, he says, "Your action desperate, threat to human survival, no conceivable justification, civilized man condemns it. We will not have mass murder. Ultimatum means war in this madness." He's a man in a high place that he can get a message like that to Kennedy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's also funny to me, though, that he's definitely from like a higher society. He's from the bourgeois class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
well, that actually goes great with the next one I have, which is the emphasis on education.
Yeah.
And that education was this equalizing power in people's lives. I actually go back to the last episode and I went on a rant about the American education system and how it has been one of the greatest forces for social equality in our country, despite its flaws that it has that we are constantly working on. And I will not get on that soapbox again. But he advocated for accessible and quality education for all individuals, and it did not matter what social or economic background they came from. He believed, like many philosophers, that education is the thing that can empower individuals and to help overcome the inequalities that society had. So it's just a big advocate of education.
His grandmother, his maternal grandmother, was a famous women's, I guess it's not necessarily women's rights, but it was kind of like a women's rights and education protester or leader in that movement. Allowing men and women in Britain to have similar educational opportunities. But I want to say this. I think this is important because Russell gets a lot of praise, I think, in this area. But in 1929, I mean, throughout his whole life, he kind of was more in support of eugenicist policies. So he was not, he thought that basically the state should be more restrictive on who they allow to be parents. In 1929, he's famous for talking about how basically people who are mentally ill, I think he says mentally defective, should be basically sexually sterilized because they're going to have basically dumb kids and how that's going to hurt the community. So is big on education, but philosophers make mistakes too.
They do. They do. Well, yeah. And with all that, he was a big advocate for freedom of speech, for people, individuals to be able to express their views freely. He's definitely against authoritarianism, which, of course, an authoritarian government want to suppress freedom of speech and rights.
Of course.
And I do think this is really fascinating about women's rights. He was a big supporter of women's suffrage in Great Britain.
Yeah.
And equal opportunities for women in education and employment and all those aspects of public life. And if you think about some of the upcoming episodes we have, we're going to do a series on what we call the Oxford Four, which is four very prominent women gained philosophy degrees from Oxford in the 1940s. You know, and I think of Simone de Beauvoir and her ability to pass the civil exam to be able to teach. That was also in the 1930s or 40s. I can't remember which. And you know, yeah. I'm not saying Russell is specifically responsible for those particular things, but again, just another thing, another social concern that he was very active about, which was advocating for women's rights.
Yeah. And it would definitely be influential having such a prominent male figure advocating for women to have any sort of increased access to education and making that space.
Yeah. I mean, if you're like, if you can telegram the president of the United States, you probably have a little influence.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Especially during the Cold War, to be able to say something directly to the president.
Well, should I say Russell Stan?
I don't know if that's me. I don't know if that's...
Oh, I think it is.
I'm not a big Russell lover by any means.
Well, it seems you appreciate his place in philosophical history.
I do. I do appreciate his place in philosophical history. I think Russell was a great, he's like a foundationalist to, well, that sounds weird. He was a good, he provided a lot of good foundation to future philosophy. I mean, one of this discussion questions that I had written down was, how have Russell's ideas influenced the way we think about the world?
I was just getting ready to ask that.
We've talked a little bit about how in mathematical, like mathematics, basically given undergrad and graduate students an awful class they have to take. But but also in things like in mathematics for AI and computer science, I mean, that's one facet. But when we've talked a lot, especially in the past year, when we've talked more about existentialist philosophies, the analytic tradition and the continental tradition. Mm-hmm. And he's the big granddaddy of the analytic tradition that so many philosophers, especially in the United States, claim that they're in that field. I mean, it's really been established a new modern field of philosophy for most of American academics.
And from what I read about college departments, philosophy departments in college, is they're largely analytical.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially in the United States and in England.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a few colleges that have some continental faculty members, but the great programs, I mean, the great meaning that you'll get a decent job after you graduate from the PhD program. What's that? Tufts is the best master's program in the U.S. for philosophy, and they specifically say on their website that we will not, like, you need to be doing work in analytic philosophy. So,
and that's Russell.
Yeah.
The granddaddy. Another guy who was not so bad at the mathematics was a fellow named Ludwig Wittgenstein, and that's who our next episode is going to be over. He's definitely in the lineage of Bertrand Russell. They were contemporaries of each other. Oh, do you have any, like, quick info on that, Andrew? Like, their relationship or... as far as their lineage goes, like, was it like Russell begot Wittgenstein sort of situation?
Yeah, I think basically so. I'll double check this for next week, but it's my understanding that Russell was basically teaching at Cambridge when Wittgenstein was a student there. And I think Wittgenstein was just like really smart student and Russell was really intrigued and they ended up working together. And I don't know if, I think there might've been some kind of mentor mentee relationship at one point, but Wittgenstein outpassed Russell for sure.
He did. And I've heard it said that Wittgenstein is the most important or influential philosopher of the 20th century. Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk about his books next week that that help substantiate that point or that claim. But anyway, y'all tune in for that.
I'm just curious if what's y'all's thoughts on Russell?
I think he seems really cool. I haven't read a whole lot of his work. I think really the only thing of his that I've read is that one chapter. But I mean, evidenced by my remembering of it all this time later, very influential and very successful about communicating just the points that he's trying to make. If I can clearly remember everything, like the whole chapter 2 years later. So I would definitely like to read more of his work.
Yeah, for me, like him or don't like him, you can't escape him. And there's a handful of philosophers that you say that about. Of course, Plato and Aristotle.
Yeah.
And he's in line with that particular group of philosophers, I think. Who knows if 500, 1,000 years from now, if he will still retain that level of importance. But I run into him all the time when I'm researching for class, or certainly even use him directly for class. He is a prominent and important philosopher in the 20th century and really ushered in some new ways of looking at things, which, as often happens in philosophy, future philosophers take that work and continue to work on it and improve upon it. And a lot of that, the heritage or the lineage goes back to Bertrand Russell. And I think he's a fascinating individual as well.
Yeah, he is one of the people that's always referenced in my classes, my political philosophy class, philosophy classes, him and Kant are kind of the big two that I couldn't really go more than a week without somebody somewhere referencing them, whether it was a lecture or it was a piece of reading we had to do. Everybody has something to say.
Yeah. How about you, Andrew? Round us out.
I think that he's a great educator of philosophy, and that's how I appreciate him. Do I think he's a great philosopher? Probably not. But I think I really respect especially the history of Western philosophy. I think that's like such a great book and very good. But if anybody's interested, I also agree. Like, I'll definitely co-sign the Mr. Parsons opinion about him just being a really, really interesting individual. If you're interested at all in him as a person, I would really recommend the BBC like 25-minute interview that he has. It's so fascinating, and it's really cool to see such a influential guy on screen. Really cool interview. And he has, maybe we can end on this note, actually. He's very famous. It's funny. This is such a great transition, actually. It's almost ironic. In the interview, the interviewee asks Russell what advice he would have for a civilization that's like 1,000 years in the future or something. What advice could he give to future generations? And this is a great place to end. So he says, the interviewer says, suppose, Lord Russell, this film would be looked at by our descendants like a Dead Sea Scroll in 1,000 years' time. What would you think it's worth telling the generation about the life you've lived and the lessons you've learned in it? Russell says, I should like to say two things. One is intellectual and one is moral. The intellectual thing I should want to say to them is this. When you're studying any matter or considering any philosophy, ask yourself only what are the facts and what is the truth that the facts they bear out. Never let yourself be diverted either by what you wish to believe or by what you think would have beneficent social effects if they were believed, but look only and solely at what are the facts. That is the intellectual thing that I should wish to say. The moral thing I should wish to say to them is very simple. I should say love is wise, hatred is foolish. In this world, which is getting more and more closely interconnected, we have to learn to tolerate each other. We have to learn to put up with the fact that some people say things we don't like. We can only live together in that. And if we are to live together and not die together, we must learn a kind of charity and a kind of tolerance, which is absolutely vital to the continuation of the human life on this planet.
Wow. Well said, Bertrand. Yeah. Now, in the interview, did he have a pipe?
Asking the real questions. I don't know. Maybe. But he has that nice British accent. I almost imitated it. All right. That's it for today's episode, everybody. We hope you enjoyed our discussion of Bertrand Russell. We really encourage you to learn more about his life and works and check out his primary material, too.
Yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode of Open Door Philosophy, this time with an episode on Russell's most famous student, Ludwig Wittgenstein. And don't forget to contact us on our socials at Open Door Philosophy or by email, and to check out our YouTube channel. That Andrew is very hard at work uploading all of our old episodes and keeping things up to date on.
And of course, we cannot go an episode with thanking our good friend, Kevin MacLeod, for the use of his free music. It's so groovy. Go check it out, people. And gosh, guys, that's it. Welcome back to the States. Andrew, we're so happy you're here.
Thank you.
Taylor, We'll be seeing you soon. And that's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Remember, when your life is in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. See ya.
Ciao.
Bye.